Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Emmy Award-winning documentarian Tim Smith. Tim joins us to talk about the award-winning documentary Rigged, the Voter Suppression Playbook. Filmed principally during the 2016 election, Rigged tracks a systematic, decade-long effort to suppress votes by undercutting the impact of a growing demographic tide of non-white and young voters who were crucial in electing Barack Obama as president in 2008. It details a variety of voter suppression plays or tactics, including purging voting rolls, passing new restrictive voter ID laws, gerrymandering, and intimidating voters from exercising their rights to vote. The film features interviews with leading voting rights advocates as well as key Republican strategists who describe how the voter suppression game is played. Jim Lehrer, former anchor of PBS NewsHour, who recently passed, described Riggs as a super work of advocacy journalism. It is a saga of rights and wrongs that deserves the attention of everyone. You can find out more about it at www.rigthefilm.com. That's one word, rigthefilm.com. Tim Smith, welcome.
Thank you very much, Alan. Pleasure to be here.
Well, the whole thing is really outrageous. And if anything, it seems to me, speaks to Donald Trump. This does. Because it's clear that the idea is anybody of color, anybody of Latino descent, is somebody he doesn't want voting. And, you know, his people, the Republicans, are out there making sure that America stays basically white. There's a question there somewhere.
Well, I mean, you know, obviously during the 2016 election, Trump, you know, the first sort of major party candidate to run on the notion that, you know, the elections were rigged. And, you know, he would tell people to go to, you know, Philadelphia and you know, watch the voting places there, that, you know, there would be all kinds of shenanigans. One of the ironies is we actually, you know, sent several crews to Philadelphia on election day, and obviously there was nothing. We found nothing. And we were with another group in North Carolina who were sort of, you know, voter fraud zealots. You know, they were looking for voter fraud, and we were with them as well. They found nothing. I mean, it's just such a lie and myth, but, yet, you know, they propagate it to sort of put these voter restriction laws into effect. And most people believe it. I mean, you talk to most Americans and say, oh, yeah, you know, voter fraud's a real thing, and I'm worried about it. I mean, they've done such a good job of sort of planting the seeds of voter fraud that, you know, even sort of centrist Americans believe in it.
Well, Tim Smith, let's talk about the issues, the ways that this is done, this rigging. Maybe we could take them one by one. Why don't you start?
Well, I mean, one of the things we, you know, we filmed in 2016 was a voter purge that happened in North Carolina in Cumberland County, where they basically, you know, took 6,000 voters, American citizens, off the roll. Some of them obviously, you know, had moved or were dead, but, you know, a number of them weren't. And we showed this. The federal court almost, you know, at the last moment overturned that voter purge because it happened more than, you know, closer to the election than 90 days, so that it was an illegal purge, and yet that didn't seem to bother them. And we found a voter who had been purged because, you know, Hurricane Matthew had basically destroyed her house, so she had to leave, so she never got the notice that, you know, her, you know, registration was being challenged. So she went to vote early, couldn't vote because she'd been purged. Once they put her back on the registration roll just a few hours before, you know, election day, she couldn't get off that day because, you know, she was a nurse's aide and couldn't get off. So lo and behold, it worked. You know, they had purged her vote. Another case we found was voter intimidation in Rock Springs, Texas, where a Republican sheriff running for election arrested this felon who had voted in 2014. This was 2016. She decided not to arrest him until, you know, August of 2016. He was Hispanic. The town she was running for sheriff in, the county she was running for sheriff in, was 50% Latino. So basically what she was trying to do was send a message, if you're Latino and you vote, you can end up in jail like this guy. And the sad part is he spent 18 months in jail without a trial, you know, so much for the right to a fair and speedy trial. We actually got him a lawyer, and he finally pled guilty because he was a felon and he shouldn't have voted. But, you know, basically he asked if he could vote. The woman at the election precinct said, sure, you know, your name's right here. Well, it turns out his name was the same as his grandfather, who was like 90 years old. I mean, all she had to do was look at the birth date of his grandfather, and you know, realized that this guy who was 40 was not didn't look, you know, like he was born in 1915, which was the birth date. So that's another example that we found was voter intimidation. Lo and behold, she went on to win. We also looked at Shelby versus Holder, which was the Supreme Court decision in 2013, which did away with the pre-clearance clause of the Voting Rights Act. And after that was done away with by Supreme Court Justice Roberts, who basically was a clerk for William Rehnquist, who was a Supreme Court justice. He also, one of the ironies is Rehnquist was a clerk during the Brown versus Board of Education, and he advocated that separate but equal was fine and that the Supreme Court shouldn't overturn it. So there's a long sort of litany and heritage there. But once Shelby versus Holder passed, a number of states, including North Carolina and Texas, quickly put into effect voter ID laws, which the Justice Department had stopped with the preclearance. So, you know, that's another example of sort of this basically nefarious strategy that's gone on since, in the film we say, since 2008, you know, at a sort of a very high rate, because Obama won in 2008 with 25% of the vote being non-white. So Republicans at that point decided, you know, we got to do something. You know, we can either appeal to this new rising demographic of non-white voters or figure out ways to, you know, prevent them from voting. And lo and behold, they chose the latter.
So the voter identification laws, maybe you could explain a little bit, because to most people, the idea that you go in and you show your driver's license or you show a voter ID of some kind doesn't sound too unusual. We know why it's being done. You're quite right. But it's very hard to argue it.
Well, I mean, the argument is, the system, you know, not broke, why fix it? You know, there wasn't widespread voter fraud. I mean, people could use their, you know, utility bills or, you know, other ways of approving their identification. It's not that even, you know, that people argue that they should, people haven't proved who they are, but, you know, 10% of the population, it's been shown, do not have driver's license. So, and yet this is the, and the Republicans know this, and they, you know, they know that a much higher percentage of blacks and Latinos do not have driver's licenses than whites. So that's what they focus on. You know, in Texas, you know, you can use your gun permit to vote, but you can't use a university-issued ID. So that's the way they deal with younger voters.
Right.
You know, there's just so many, you know, reasons for making these voter ID laws, you know, very more restrictive, because it just focuses on, you know, the non-white voters.
Well, the whole thing is infuriating, but I'm old enough now to remember quite well the good old days when, you know, they made you recite the Constitution if you wanted to vote. So are we going back to that point? Do you think it's as effective as it used to be in discouraging voting?
Well, I think it's more effective in the sense that it, you know, it's more sort of insidious. It's more sort of under the radar. You know, I think most Americans think the, you know, the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965 and, you know, there's no problems. And, you know, if you're African-American or Latino, you don't think that. But, you know, I think most whites are sort of unaware of this sort of campaign to basically restrict, you know, non-white voters. And, you know, it's just not getting a lot of notice, which is why we made this film, why we went out in 2016 to sort of look at what was happening on the ground and you know, captured some pretty amazing stuff.
Now, along comes Donald Trump, and he gets elected. And basically, there's really no secret about this. He's on the other side. Clearly, the fewer people of color, the fewer people of Hispanic origin that vote, the better off he thinks he is. Am I wrong about that?
Yes. I mean, that's his base. I mean, you know, sort of white, rural, you know, non-college educated voters. Yes. And, you know, this is sort of, you know, resonates with them. The idea that, you know, in the film, Mark McKinnon, who was a Republican strategist for Bush, talks about something has changed in America, and there's just a lot of resentment about what's going on, and people basically, you know, think it's because of, you know, African Americans or Latinos are getting breaks that they're not getting, and that's why they're being, you know, held down economically.
Now, this is a worldwide phenomenon, right? I mean, we're seeing countries all over the world who want to exclude people coming in from the outside. And we certainly see Brexit, which had a good deal of this as part of its rationale, you know, keep them out.
Right, close down the borders, right.
Well, I mean, does the United States have the ability, if it wanted, if it elects a Democrat, for example, the next time, does it have the ability to say, hey, cut it out, we're not going to be that way when there's a worldwide phenomenon going on?
I'm not sure how the election is going to go in 2020. I think more and more Americans are realizing it's going in the wrong direction, and I can only hope that, you know, Americans decide that, you know, sort of the politics and culture of what Trump exemplifies is not the American way, and, you know, it's not fair, it's not right.
Let me stop you there, Tim. Every poll shows the Republicans are sticking with him.
Yes.
Huge numbers, huge, fierce adherence. I think what we have here is a white phenomena, which is this has been our country all along. We don't want to give it away. And you let, quote, those people vote, and they're going to take it away from us. So we don't want that to happen. Isn't that what it's all about? Because if you get over 90% of the people who are consistently with Trump, no matter what horrible thing he does, that's going to tell you a lot about the way this country's divided.
Well, I think what you saw last week with the impeachment trial, and, you know, Republican senators basically not wanting to hear facts or, you know, the truth about what Trump did, it just shows that that's where, you know, no one cares about democracy anymore. Or you know, fair trial. It's scary, and I think to some degree, this voter suppression effort was sort of the canary in the coal mine. That was the first sort of sign that we were moving in this undemocratic direction.
Well, now, Donald Trump loves to accuse people of doing things he's doing. And I love the irony in your adopting a title which is rigged. Of course, he went around saying everything's rigged. But of course, right. We all know right now, he's the rigger.
Right. Yeah. No, it's the opposite of what he says it is. It's rigged, all right, but it's rigged against non-white voters. It's rigged against, you know, people who are poor or young students. You know, it's basically rigged against any voter who wouldn't vote for Trump.
So when you were thinking about how to do this and how to do this film, what were your motivations?
Well, we knew it was a problem, but we also knew at the same time it would be very, you know, it's hard to talk about voting in a way that is cinematic because no one dies. But we wanted to, you know, really bring the story to life. We actually had an earlier version of the film, which was Verite, which, you know, with no narration, but it just didn't seem to hold together. And so we basically, you know, struggled with it, and we came up with what we called the, you know, the voter suppression playbook, and we decided to break it down by plays. We knew we needed a narrator. We found a great one in Jeffrey Wright, you know, the actor on HBO's Westworld, and he's won a Tony and an Emmy, and he's just, you know, very powerful speaker and presence and really cares about this issue. And he did you know, spent a day with us, you know, shooting stand-ups, shooting the narration pro bono, which was wonderful. So, you know, I think we came up with a good solution with our playbook. You know, we have 9 plays in the film. You know, we show how each one happened and basically, you know, chronicle it over a 10-year period from 2008 when Obama wins to basically 2018, which was actually, you know, sort of an interesting election in the sense that there was a lot of good news in that election because people turned out at an unprecedented rate, the most number of voters since 1914 in terms of by-year election. So, but, you know, there's also some sad news that came out of that election.
Indeed. Tim Smith, so I wanted to ask you about this. Rigged, something about rigging an election. I sit on the air every morning from 9 to 11, and we take emails along with a panel. And one of the popular things that people are saying is, he's not going to ever have another election. There is an absolute belief he will rig it to the point where he will say, it's going to be rigged, so I'm calling off the elections. Is that possible?
I don't think that that's possible. I think there's other things that could happen. I mean, I know they're talking about sort of finding ways to change the Electoral College so that, you know, like if he carries some districts in a state, congressional districts, that he would get points for that, or the Republican candidate down the road would get points for that. So, you know, you could carry Michigan, you know, the Democrat could carry Michigan, but the Republican candidate carried 3 congressional districts because they all have been gerrymandered in Michigan. So he or she would get, you know, points for that. So, you know, they're just, I, the one thing about the Republicans is they're very smart. They keep evolving. They keep changing the ways to rig elections. You know, the U.S. Census question on citizenship, you know, that was a new idea in Florida, for instance. Students at the University of Florida brought a lawsuit that there were no polling places on the campus in Gainesville, even though I think 60 or 70% of the voters in Gainesville go to the University of Florida. So, you know, the court said, yes, you need to put a polling place on the campus at Gainesville. And then the Republicans in the legislature came up with the idea that, well, you know, each polling place would need to have X amount of parking places. Well, you know, just what, college campuses don't have parking places. It's always a problem, every college campus. So, you know, even when a court decision goes against them, they come up with a new innovative way. Again, Amendment 4 in Florida, where felons were put back on the ballot, you know, at a 65% in 2018 they voted. And then the legislature and the governor, trifecta of, you know, Republicans in the Senate and House in Florida and the governor, came up with this idea that, well, sure, you can go back on the roll if you're a felon, but you have to pay your court fees and any fines and so on and so forth, which can run $10,000 or more. So, you know, again, a new sort of poll tax. I mean, it's just, it's innovative, it's dark, it's nefarious, but, you know, it's very effective.
Talk to me about what is the American Issues Initiative?
The American Issues Initiative is sort of the organization we set up to tackle what we think are important issues that aren't getting enough attention and coming up with solutions for those issues. And the first one we wanted to take on was democracy and sort of the erosion of the American democracy. So that's why we did Rigged. Other issues would be criminal reform, education reform, health care. But, you know, this is the first issue we decided to focus on and are really going to keep at this until November 2020.
Well, now this takes real guts. So tell me, you know, again, I want to ask you, what got you involved in this whole thing? In other words, this takes your time, it takes your energy, it takes your resources. So tell us what motivated you to get involved.
Well, my background was as a documentary producer, a television producer. Before doing this, I was at MSNBC in their documentary unit. A gentleman came to me who had worked at, who was a, you know, head of M&A at Goldman Sachs, very worried about sort of the state of our democracy, wanted to make a film about this topic. You know, it was something I was aware of, but sort of not immersed in. And so the more and more I found out about it, you know, as a result of deciding, of agreeing to do this film, the more and more alarmed I became and continue to be. I mean, it's not going, you know, we started this in 2016, and it's not going in a good direction, even though, you know, the Republicans become, and I'm not a sort of a Democrat. I mean, I'm an independent, you know, but it's scary. And you know, like, we want to let people know what's going on and get them engaged and get them to register to vote and to vote and to be aware of what's going on.
Are your parents still alive?
No.
How much influence would you attribute in terms of this, what I would consider heroic work? Would you say this is what my parents taught me?
Ironically, they were Republicans, but even they would be upset about this and wouldn't embrace what Trump is doing. And, you know, in the film itself, we have a number of Republicans who are sort of aghast at what's going on that we spoke to, and they're in the film.
Those are the old. Those are the old Republicans. They're
yeah,
they're
sort of, you know, I mean, yeah. You're based in all the, you know, the Rockefeller Republicans. And, you know, I've worked a lot over the years with Tom Kaine, who's another one of these, you know, the former governor of New Jersey and ran the 9/11 commission. I mean, that's the type of Republicans that, you know, used to be, but, you know, no longer exist. And basically Trump is, you know, pushing them out. And, you know, with Steve Bannon and his zealotry, you know, moving so far to the right and so far beyond what is American. I mean, that's the important thing. This is not American. It's not about Democrats and Republicans. It's about America.
Well, of course, that's not what they're thinking, but I wanted
no.
to ask you something. You just mentioned MSNBC, where you used to work.
Right.
Now, I have to admit that in my house, where my wife controls the clicker, you know, we watch a lot of MSNBC. You got MSNBC, you got CNN, which is increasingly anti-Trump, and then you got Fox, which carries the message, carries the mail. What do you make of that whole thing where the conservative part of the country watches only one station?
And well, I mean, it's just, you know, everything has been bifurcated, you know, and so partisan, and it's just very scary.
Yeah, but what was it like working at MSNBC? Did the commissars read out the orders in the morning? And I say that facetiously, of course. But were you told this is where we are, this is where we're positioned?
No, it wasn't that way. I mean, I was working in the sort of the, you know, documentary area. So I wasn't doing the sort of the nightly Rachel Maddow, Chris Matthews programming. But, you know, I didn't feel like it was, you know, you were told what to do or what to say.
So when we look at the Rachel Maddows, who is a heroine in American politics to so many people for center left, and Chris Matthews, not so much, but still there. How much of all of this resistance to rigged elections and everything else comes from personality?
I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think their points of view obviously add fuel to the fire of people on the left, and obviously sort of, you know, between Fox and MSNBC, obviously there's a huge partisan divide, and, you know, it's like you on one channel and you get one view, and on the other you get the other. So, but, you know, and that certainly hasn't helped in terms of partisanship. But, you know, I think MSNBC does a much better job at sort of conveying the real world than obviously Fox does.
Let's talk a little bit about the press in general. You're fighting for fairness in elections and the American democracy and keeping it fair and whole and approachable. Has the press been opinionated, or have they backed what you're doing, whether it's specifically for you and your documentary, but for, you know, just what's right?
I mean, in some respects, you know, I think the press and obviously networks as well, like, look at what we did as partisan, you know, because it takes a Democrat point of view. And yet, you know, and I've really wrestled with this. It's a bit like Nazi Germany. I mean, if you said the Nazis, you know, were against Jews, that was the truth. And, you know, it wasn't partisan. It was just telling the truth. And what we're trying to do in this film is tell the truth and show the truth. It's not like Democrats haven't done gerrymandering in the past or done voter suppression in the past. Yes, but, you know, right now the issue is really about the Republican Party, and to say otherwise is just not to speak the truth. So we've been really wrestling with this, you know, idea that, you know, on the one hand and on the other hand, and it's just so clear cut where with this issue of voter suppression, that it is being practiced in a way much greater and much more widespread by the Republican Party than it is by the Democratic Party.
Which is ironic, of course, because the very people who are Republicans now used to be the Democratic Party down
right.
in the South, right? You want to talk about that
a minute? Obviously the whole Jim Crow thing grew out of the Democratic Party in the late part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. And that the Republicans were the one who, you know, obviously had the black voters. I mean, obviously switched on during FDR's era, but, you know, for a long, long time, you know, African Americans were Republicans.
So every time I mention the word Nazi relating to Trump, I get mail and a how dare yous and letters. You mention the word Nazi. Seems to me a lot of what's going on in this country is out of the Nazi playbook. You look back at Hitler and how he built his organization and what he said and who he arrested, and you have certain similarities. You think that's going too far?
You know, it's sort of a third rail issue. I think, yes, I mean, there are plays. I mean, obviously the big lie was part of what the Nazis did. I think voter fraud is one of the big lies that, you know, the Republicans are practicing. I mean, there are sort of ways to sort of move opinion and change minds. And, you know, the Nazis obviously are very good at this, and the Republicans are very good at it.
Tim Smith, so I got a question for you. You've talked about how elections are being rigged by voter suppression and keeping people away from the polls. One of the things that has plagued me over the years as a political scientist, as a professor, has been, hey, If everybody voted, 50% of America doesn't vote to begin with in a presidential election, right? 50%.
Yeah. Well, I think presidential elections are usually a little higher than that, but yes.
I've always...
In the U.S., it's much lower than it should be. Lower than other countries.
And Tim Smith, we do know that out of the half that doesn't vote, there are more Democrats than Republicans. In other words, Republicans exercise the franchise. They're protecting what they have as opposed to the have-nots. So my question to you, sir, and I know you've studied this, is why not? In other words, why don't people vote who could change their lives?
Well, obviously, you know, participation in elections, it sort of correlates with wealth and also correlates with education. I think people who don't vote generally, you know, feel that the system is skewed against them. So what's the point? They don't think their vote will matter. They're just cynical about what happens in elections and that no one seems to pay much attention to them anyway. So, you know, no matter, you know, if they vote or not. So I think it's just, based on cynicism.
Well,
you know, that the system is rigged against, you know, non-white people and, you know, rigged against poor people. So why vote?
Right. So that's your premise and that's your hypothesis and you've built a film around that. And yet, many people, including me, to be fair, say, just get off your behinds and get out there and vote. If you want your kids to have more milk, if you want to have the kinds of resources that are available in this country, and they won't do it. Now, when Barack Obama runs, he's, of course, African-American. And it made a big difference, a huge turnout of blacks in this country.
Right.
So how do you achieve that if you have white candidates?
Well, I mean, you know, another point is gerrymandering has basically, you know, taken away a lot of people's votes because, you know, if a district has been packed or cracked, you know, packed with sort of Democrats and, you know, to vote. So what's the point of voting? Because, you know, their candidate's going to win anyway, or cracked where, you know, non-white voters are distributed across all these different districts so Republicans can win. You know, there's cynicism of, you know, what's the point? So, you know, there's just with all the money that's come into the system, you know, because of Citizens United. So, again, there's more cynicism, you know, that a Tom Steyer or, a Bloomberg is going to win because, you know, they're billionaires. So, I mean, the system is really, it's scary, but I agree with you. People should vote, and that's the only way to change things.
So
and obviously, Stacey Abrams is working very hard to do that, and she goes out and registers voters. And then, you know, once they get registered, you know, you got to work even harder to get them to go out and vote. So, there's a lot of heavy lifting involved, but it's important to do it.
As a college professor, I can tell you, I know that. Getting people out. Okay, let's talk a little bit about gerrymandering. You brought it up. It's interesting because eventually it doesn't work. Now, we're talking to you, of course, from New York State right now. And, you know, the Senate was constitutionally Republican in a blue state because of the gerrymander.
Right.
One day, as I often say, you know, mirror, mirror on the wall, the Republican leader looked up at the mirror and said, or the computer, and said, draw me a district where we can't lose. And the computer looked back at him, the mirror looked back at him and said, sorry, boss, not enough votes to go around, no matter what you do. That happens, doesn't it?
It happens, but what really happened in 2010 and is happening since is they've come up with these new computer software packages that can draw these districts. I mean, take North Carolina as an example. I mean, it's a state that's like 51% Democratic and 49% Republican, you know, in terms of registered voters. I mean, obviously there are independents in there, but, you know, in terms of the ratio, it's about 51 to 49. There are 10 congressmen, you know, Republican congressmen and 3, you know, Democratic congressmen in this state that is basically more skewed towards Democrats. I mean, they obviously are very effective at sort of, you know, packing all the Democratic voters into a very few districts and cracking the rest of the voters into many districts, to get that ratio. It's just, and it's not just North Carolina, it's Ohio and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and they've done it not only for congressional districts, but also for the state legislatures, which allows them to pass voter restriction laws.
Right. Now, if this is the case, and you said before, people are saying, what's the use? The system is skewed. It's already set up. We can't win. We're not going to. I don't agree with that. I don't think most people who don't vote are thinking intellectually. I think they just don't do it. I know that we may disagree on that, but the people that I've spoken with, it isn't as if they're PhDs in political science or whatever. They just say, yeah, you know, I haven't got the time. I don't want to do it.
Well, you know, I think 2018, to agree with you, obviously showed that if you vote and if you turn out, you know, they were able to move the, you know, the House of Representatives from a Republican House to a Democratic House, despite the fact these are gerrymandered districts. So, yes, I mean, and, you know, they turned out, as I said earlier, at an unprecedented rate to vote in, you know, 2018 versus, you know, the most since 1914. So it obviously makes sense to turn out and vote. I wouldn't disagree with that.
So talk to me about partisanship. I wrote a book years ago about the Wisconsin legislature, strengthening the Wisconsin legislature. If you want, you can get it for a buck on Amazon. But it was the fiercest, almost, you know, warlike relationship between the Democrats and the Republicans, guys whose names were once very powerful, David Obie and people like that, who've been completely forgotten now on both sides, and all of the Republicans who eventually, Jerris Leonard and others who went to work in the Nixon administration. So I want to ask you a question. Based on your work, and that work has to do with whether people can be stopped from voting, how important is partisanship in a state legislature in determining whether people, whether they're going to set up these draconian laws which prevent people from voting?
I mean, it's very important, and obviously Wisconsin is a great example of that, of, you know, passing laws that, you know, make it harder to vote. I mean, they put the, you know, voter ID law they passed in 2011, and obviously it was a state that went for Trump by not a lot of votes in 2016. So obviously, it, you know, which helped him win the election. You know, you can argue that maybe Hillary should have gone to Wisconsin, but
you certainly
know,
can, yes.
The voter ID law certainly had an effect. And one other thing I want to say is, you know, in terms of gerrymandering, which we were speaking about earlier, I mean, the Republicans in 2010 did what was called Project Red Map, which basically took over a number, including Wisconsin, a number of state legislatures by not spending a ton of money. It was like $30 million. But, you know, the Democrats could have done this, but they didn't. I mean, the Republicans are much better at fighting this war than the Democrats have been. You know, Holder has recently set up a committee, a redistricting committee, to sort of do what Project Red Map did in 2010. So they're sort of late to the party, but, you know, better late than never. So, but again, the Republicans, you know, and they're doing it legally. They're not, you know, it's not underhanded. They're just much more effective at sort of, you know, taking over state legislatures, passing these laws that work for them and help them continue to have control. So, you know, it's not just the Republicans, you know, doing bad things. It's the Democrats not playing, you know, the game as well as they should.
Tim Smith, tell me about courts. How do courts figure in all of this? We got a clearly pro-Trump Supreme Court right now. You can almost predict what's going to happen when a particular case comes up before them. And now, if he wins again, you're going to have maybe an enduring legacy of Republican-based Trumpian control of the courts. And they're not stupid. They put young people on. They know what they're doing. So I'm going to ask you this. Could you detail for us where your frustrations have been in your project on voter suppression in the courts?
Well, I mean, one of the things we show in the film is that in 2016, court decisions actually were very helpful in sort of stopping voter suppression from being even worse than it was in 2016. The federal courts overturned the voter ID law in Texas and North Carolina and in Wisconsin, you know, not completely, but, you know, made it less onerous.
Now, these are the lower courts, the lower federal courts.
These are the lower courts, which are actually probably more important than the Supreme Court. And since Trump became president, he's you know, nominated and appointed and put in place more than 150 new federal courts on the district level. And those are the ones that make the initial decisions. Those are the ones who made the decisions to sort of overturn those voter ID laws in 2016. You know, eventually the case could get to the Supreme Court, but, you know, at the time, you know, it has an effect. So And basically, you just need the president, you need the Senate to sort of decide who the new federal court judges are going to be, both in the supreme level and sort of the district level. And Trump is just, you know, and McConnell have really sort of taken care of this, and most of them are run through the Federalist Society, which is a very conservative think tank, very effective at sort of identifying these conservative judges and just basically bringing them to the White House and saying, here's your next judge for North Carolina, or here's your next judge for Texas, and, you know, basically they rubber stamp it.
Okay, so now you have this impeachment trial. You saw the Senate was the key to it. It never looked like Trump would be convicted of the impeachment because the Senate was controlled by this very disciplined Republican group.
Right.
But you have the possibility now that the Senate will go Democratic. It's a possibility. I'm not predicting it, but I think, although I have, I think that what these senators did in not allowing the witnesses and loading the discussion may mean that some of them are going to be very, very vulnerable in this election. Tell me, in terms of your work on voter suppression, whether a Democratic Senate, in addition to a Democratic House, would make a difference, even assuming one way that Trump stays the president or isn't the president.
I think it would obviously make a big difference in terms of federal judges going forward, even though a lot of these obviously, Trump judges will be in place forever until they die. I think it could make a difference. I mean, H.R. 1, which passed House Bill 1 in the House this spring, represented a lot of new ideas to open up elections, including making Tuesday a national holiday, you know, Election Day, a national holiday, and a number of other sort of reforms. So, yes, I think it would be critical to sort of, you know, have Democrats in control of the trifecta of the House and the Senate and the White House.
We're talking with Tim Smith, executive producer of the award-winning documentary Rigged, The Voter Suppression Playbook. You can find out more about the film at www.riggedthefilm. That's one word, riggedthefilm.com. Okay, so let's proceed on this. If the Democrats take the Senate, in terms of legislation, potential legislation, following up on your, you know, voter suppression issues, what could they do? What laws would you like to see passed?
Well, for instance, you know, obviously reinstate the preclearance clause into the Voting Rights Act, and maybe make it, you know.
Whoa! Because some people don't get it all. Tell us what that is.
Well, the preclearance clause was done away with in the Shelby versus Holder decision, which basically sort of focused on a number of mostly southern states, although I think the Bronx was part of it too, that they would have to pre-clear any voting law changes through the U.S. Justice Department. So in the past, if the law seemed to discriminate against African Americans or Latinos, the Justice Department would strike it down and say, hey, Texas, you can't do a voter ID law, which actually Texas had done like in 2011, and the Justice Department struck it down. So if that clause was put back in, and now they're talking about sort of making it not just for southern states, but for the whole country, since states like Wisconsin and Ohio also practice some bad voting practices in terms of non-white voters. So that would be a great first step to sort of reclaim that clause for the Voting Rights Act.
Well, you know, one of the frustrations for people like me who've been watching this series of occurrences under this president has been the role of the Attorney General, who you just mentioned, Attorney General
Right.
Barr, who has turned out to be nothing more, in my opinion, than an apparatchik for the president. How important do you see Barr in all of this?
I mean, I don't think his heart is in the right place with voting rights, but I can't sort of, you know, put my finger on anything he's done in that area specifically.
If people want laws enforced, they have to go to the Justice Department. I mean, I think one of the things that was so fascinating about this recent trial was the idea that they would subpoena somebody and they would put their hand up to their nose and say, I'm not obeying the subpoena and there's nothing you can do about it. Where were they going to go? They had to go to the Justice Department, and the Justice Department sure wasn't going to help them.
Right, and certainly the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department is very quiescent. So, yes, I agree that they're not, you know, they're obviously not enforcing the law in terms of civil rights cases as they have in the past under Obama or even under George Bush.
Where'd you get the money, Tim Smith, to do this award-winning documentary?
This gentleman, who sort of started the whole concept, Mac Heller, who was with, had retired from Goldman Sachs, helped fund the initial phases of the film. We've also gotten grants from a number of foundations.
And what did you need the money for?
Basically just to, obviously do the production itself. We started shooting in September of 2016 and basically, shot for another year or so. And so it was a two-year production process. And now, we're also, doing a lot of social media. We're doing outreach. We're doing our screenings. We're going nationwide. So we're spending, some money to get the word out.
I've often wondered about documentaries. Where do they go? In other words, you can get them on public television, maybe. You might get them in one or two theaters in New York City, but unlikely. I've often wondered, a lot of people are making documentaries, but I'm always wondering, how do you get to see them?
As I said, it's on Amazon Prime, so that's, 150 million subscribers.
Do 150 million subscribers watch it?
No, but, it is available to, obviously a large audience. And if you, through social media, make people aware of that, and also, yesterday I was, obviously in New Lebanon, New York, doing a screening. There were 100 people there, and, that gets the word out, and then, it's sort of geometric. Not, people come up to me afterwards and say, I'd like to screen it. So, we're making the film available for free. We're not, there's no screening fee, via DVD. So, we're really trying to get the word out. We're trying to go to as many places as possible. We were at the, Congressional Black Caucus screening. We were at Netroots in Philadelphia. We're at the Howard Baker Public Policy Center at the University of Tennessee. We've been at Stanford Law School. We've been at Michigan Law School. So we're going around the country, basically showing the film, talking about the film, having voting rights panel discussions, weekly find panelists. So we're really doing this as an education campaign. I mean, the film itself is just sort of a springboard to, ignite a national conversation on this topic.
So what are your major frustrations?
I think what I said earlier, that people view this as partisan, but it's not. It's just, we're just telling the truth. We're just showing what happened and what continues to happen. And, it could have been the Democrats doing this, but in this case, it was the Republicans. And, you just have to call what you see, call balls and strikes. And right now we're seeing a lot of strikes coming from, Republican pitchers.
Now, there has been a huge change in the Republican Party. You mentioned Howard Baker. You mentioned the Bushes.
Right.
These are very different people than what's walking the streets right now, aren't they?
Yes. Very different people. I mean, I just think, look at Pompeo and what he did to that, NPR
yeah.
reporter.
Right.
I mean, it's bully tactics. It's just not the way American politicians or any politician should act or behave. I mean, and they're just trying to eviscerate freedom of the press. It's very worrying.
So there's the should word.
It's not just about voter suppression. It's about a lot of other democratic principles.
Sure, but there's the should. I mean, if you go back to the early 30s and you look at what Hitler was doing, you see the same playbook. You shut down the press, you basically interfere with who's voting, you do all of that stuff, and we're in that mold right now. It's just awful.
Well, I mean, it seems that we're sliding that way, but, if you take American history and you look at, McCarthy in the early 50s and his big lie of, I have 51 or how many it was, people from the State Department, who are communists.
Sure.
I mean, just making things up and just keep saying it. I mean, it's happened in this country, too.
Tim Smith, what'd you major in college?
American civilization.
And
which seems to be on the decline.
So you majored in American civilization. You know American politics for what they are. Is it hopeless?
No. I mean, I take a lot of hope out of what happened in 2018 with the turnout, with the changes of Congress that Americans wanted to have a check and balance and obviously felt that we at least needed a Democratic House to check what was going on. And, there are a lot of sort of local organizations working, beyond just the Democratic Party, to get new candidates to run, and it's it'll be interesting to see what happens tonight with the Iowa caucus. You know, what the turnout will be. You know, will it be like in 2008 when Obama ran and very high turnout, or will it, you know, people not turn out? We'll see. I think they will.
You know, people quite frequently tell me that they look to the blue election that changed the House of Representatives. And yet, you know, that has happened both with Bill Clinton, the Democrat, who lost to the Republicans, and now the other way around. And you mentioned that it's just a matter of, you know, having other options. Do you think it's that rather than on this individual president?
I think it probably could have. Well, I mean, the economy was in great shape. So generally, you know, the House doesn't switch when the economy wasn't as good a shape as our economy was in 2018. So I think it was sort of a mandate about President Trump.
Let's take a look at some of the contemporary candidates for president and take a look at Bernie Sanders, for example, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, now Mike Bloomberg. You, as somebody who has been working on this project on voting rights, do you look at these candidates and say there's a difference?
Well, obviously, yeah. I mean, there's a, in terms of Warren and Sanders, they're much more to the left than Biden or Bloomberg or Buttigieg. But, you know, so there is a difference. But, you know, it's important. I think a lot of people feel, you know, it doesn't matter who wins as long as the Democrat wins.
Yeah, but I'm asking you a specific question. Have you heard anything in the rhetoric of these candidates that deal with your voter suppression playbook?
Well, actually, that's a very good question. In the debates, there's been very, very little talk of voter suppression. I think the one in Georgia, they spoke about a little because, you know, Stacey Abrams is in Georgia, but it really hasn't been addressed much by the candidates or in the debates. Again, it continues to be under the radar.
Now, you've mentioned Stacey Abrams a number of times. However, in her race, she lost.
Yes.
Well, what do you make of that? In other words, you have...
I mean, here's an, you know, I don't know if irony is the right word, but she ran against the Secretary of State for Georgia, Brian Kemp, who has done a very good job. We spoke earlier about purges, at purging right. voters from the roll. I mean, despite the fact that Georgia has a very, you know, one of the highest growth rates of any state, it actually has fewer voters on the roll now than it did in 2010. So, you know, Kemp was very good at sort of purging the rolls, using what's called perfect match, where if, you know, your middle name is not the same as on your birth certificate, or, you know, your middle name is Ebenezer, but you sign up as Timothy E. Smith, you know,
sure.
You know, you can't vote. I mean, you get knocked off. So, you know, and eventually you might get put back on, but you miss that election. So, you know, so obviously she did very well for, you know, a Democratic candidate, and Georgia increasingly seems to be moving to become a purple state. So I think in the future, you know, the Democrats might have a much better chance in Georgia than they have in the past.
Tim Smith, let me ask you about a couple of things. We're sort of running out of time here. The first is, what about online voting? You know, you talk about voter suppression, but online voting will obviously get a lot more people voting, and the opponents are yelling fraud. What do you think?
I would only be for it if I was assured that it couldn't be, you know, hacked and broken into and hijacked. You know, I think there's a lot of other things you can do. Obviously, they have mail-in voting in California and Oregon and Colorado. You know, I think that might be a better way to go than you know, online voting, unless one can be assured that it can't be hacked.
And what would it take you to assure you of that?
I'm not an IT person, but, you know, I think I would need to sort of listen to experts who would say this is, you know, the way to go. It can't be hacked. It's perfectly safe. You know, I would need to sort of be assured.
How about convicted criminals losing their right to vote?
There are two states where prisoners can vote, Maine and Vermont. but in a number of states, obviously Florida moved to let former felons vote, and there were 1.4 million former felons in Florida. So it was the biggest enfranchisement of American citizens since 18-year-olds were given the right to vote. But again, as I pointed out, the Florida legislature basically sort of totally undercut that by requiring them to pay their court fees and fines. So, but I believe they, you know, if they've done, you know, parole and they paid their debt to society, they should be able to vote. Yeah. And let me add, it makes them part of society. It makes them feel like they're in society rather than, you know, on the fringes or pushed out. So, you know, I think it's a win-win both for the felon to vote and a win for society to have these people feel like they're part of society again.
So Hillary Clinton got millions of votes more than Donald Trump.
Those were all fraudulent votes.
Yes, and Donald Trump is claiming that
3 to 5 million,
attempt to rig the election, when of course we all know who the rigging is going to be by. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Constitution of the United States and the Electoral College. Everywhere I go, people are writing me letters, seeing me, and saying, the Electoral College is unfair, and it's a voter suppression thing for the majority in this country. Is it?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's sort of a vestige of, slave America, where the southern states wanted to have enough power, and the 3/5 votes for slaves, and it's a real anachronism, going back to the early 19th century when blacks couldn't vote, and the South needed to continue to have power.
How much of what we are seeing, the division in this country, is between the people who regret the way the Civil War went and those who rejoice in it?
I mean, I think that used to be the case, probably in the 60s. I think it's much less the case now. I think there's just a lot of white anger, and it's obviously in North Carolina and in Georgia, but it's also in Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania. So, I mean, you're seeing these voter restriction laws across the country. It's not just kind of a southern phenomenon anymore.
No, we had it in New York State, as I say. The Senate would be gerrymandered, and then they ran out of steam, and then the Senate is Democratic. So I would hope that your film, Rig the Voter Suppression Playbook, gets great attention because it's so true, and I hope it leads to change because, Tim, things are not looking good from where I'm sitting right now. How about you? Are you an optimist?
I'm... I'd like to think that, things are trending in the right direction. Obviously, 2020 will tell a great deal. And obviously, another census is coming up in 2021 in redistricting. So, there's a lot to kind of rise on this election.
We've been talking with Tim Smith, executive producer of the award-winning documentary Rigged, the Voter Suppression Playbook. You can find out much more about the film at www.riggedthefilm.com. That's one word, riggedthefilm.com. Tim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Alan. It was a pleasure.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.